I strike. The stick hitting into the ground, bouncing, striking into the dust, and then into the air again, and the dust sucking on down the road faster than if a car was in it. And then I can cry, looking at the stick. It is broken down to my hand, not longer than stove wood that was a long stick. I throw it away, and I can cry. It does not make so much noise now. The cow is standing in the barn door, chewing. When she sees me come into the lot, she lows, her mouth full of flopping green, her tongue flopping. I ain't a-going to milk you. I ain't a-going to do nothing for them. I hear her turn when I pass. When I turn, she is just behind me with her sweet, hot, hard breath. Didn't I tell you I wouldn't? She nudges me, snuffing. She moans deep inside, her mouth closed. I jerk my hand, cursing her like Jewel does. Get now! I stoop my hand to the ground and run at her. She jumps back and whirls away and stops, watching me. She moans. She goes on to the path and stands there, looking up the path. It is dark in the barn, warm, smelling, silent. I can cry quietly, watching the top of the hill. Cash comes to the hill, limping where he fell off of the church. He looks down at the spring, then up the road and back toward the barn. He comes down the path stiffly and looks at the broken hitch rein and at the dust in the road and then up the road, where the dust is gone. I hope they've got clean past Tull's by now. I so hope it. Cash turns and limps up the path. Dern him! I showed him. Dern him. I am not crying now. I am not anything. Dewey Dell comes to the hill and calls me. Vardaman. I am not anything. I am quiet. You, Vardaman. I can cry quiet now, feeling and hearing my tears. Then it won't. It hadn't happened then. It was a laying right there on the ground. And now she's getting ready to cook it. It is dark. I can hear wood. Silence. I know them. But not living sounds, not even him. It is as though the dark were resolving him out of his integrity into an unrelated scattering of components. Snuffings and stampings, smells of cooling flesh and ammoniac hair, an illusion of a coordinated whole of splotched hide and strong bones within which, detached and secret and familiar and is different from my is, I see him dissolve, legs, a rolling eye, a gaudy splotching like cold flames, and float upon the dark in a fading solution. All one, yet neither. All either, yet none. I can see hearing coil toward him, caressing, shaping his hard shape, fetlock, hip, shoulder and head, smell and sound. I am not afraid. Cooked and et. Cooked and et.
Dewey Dell. He could do so much for me if he just would. He could do everything for me. It's like everything in the world for me is inside a tub full of guts, so that you wonder how there can be any room in it for anything else very important. He's a big tub of guts, and I am a little tub of guts, and if there is not any room for anything else important in a big tub of guts, how can it be room in a little tub of guts? But I know it is there because God gave women a sign. when something has happened bad. It's because I am alone. If I could just feel it, it would be different, because I would not be alone. But if I were not alone, everybody would know it. And he could do so much for me, and then I would not be alone. Then I could be all right alone. I would let him come in between me and Leif, like Darl came in between me and Leif, and so Leif is alone too. He is Leif, and I am Dewey Dell. And when Mother died, I had to go beyond and outside of me and Leif and Darl to grieve, because he could do so much for me and he don't know it. He don't even know it. From the back porch I cannot see the barn. Then the sound of Cash's sawing comes in from that way. It is like a dog outside the house, going back and forth around the house to whatever door you come to, waiting to come in. He said I worry more than you do, and I said, you don't know what worry is, so I can't worry. I try to, but I can't think long enough to worry. I light the kitchen lamp. The fish, cut into jagged pieces, bleeds quietly in the pan. I put it into the cupboard quick, listening into the hall, hearing. It took her 10 days to die. Maybe she don't know it is yet. Maybe she won't go until Cash. Or maybe until Jewel. I take the dish of greens from the cupboard and the bread pan from the cold stove, and I stop, watching the door. Where's Vardaman? Cash says. In the lamp, his sawdusted arms look like sand. I don't know, I ain't seen him. Peabody's team run away. See if you can find Vardaman. The horse will let him catch him. Well, tell them to come to supper. I cannot see the barn. I said, I don't know how to worry. I don't know how to cry. I tried, but I can't. After a while, the sound of the saw comes around, coming dark along the ground in the dust dark. Then I can see him, going up and down above the plank. You come in to supper, I say. Tell him. He could do everything for me, and he don't know it. He is his guts and I am my guts, and I am Leif's guts. That's it. I don't see why he didn't stay in town. We are country people, not as good as town people. I don't see why he didn't. Then I can see the top of the barn. The cow stands at the foot of the path, lowing. When I turn back, Cash is gone. I carry the buttermilk in. Pa and Cash and he are at the table. Where's that big fish Bud caught, sister? He says. I set the milk on the table. I never had no time to cook it. Plain turnip greens is mighty spindling eatin' for a man my size, he says. Cash is eaten. About his head, the print of his hat is sweated into his hair. His shirt is blotched with sweat. He has not washed his hands and arms. You ought to took time, Pa says. Where's Vardaman? I go toward the door. I can't find him. Here, sister, he says. Never mind about the fish. It'll save, I reckon. Come on and sit down. I ain't minding it, I say. I'm going to milk before it sets into rain. Pa helps himself and pushes the dish on, but he does not begin to eat. His hands are half closed on either side of his plate, his head bowed a little, his awry hair standing into the lamplight. He looks like right after the maul hits the steer and it no longer alive and don't yet know that it is dead. But Cash is eating, and he is too. You better eat something, he says. He is looking at Pa. Like Cash and me. You'll need it. Aye, Pa says. He rouses up like a steer that's been kneeling in a pond and you run at it. She would not begrudge me it. When I am out of sight of the house, I go fast, The cow lows at the foot of the bluff. She nuzzles at me, snuffing, blowing her breath in a sweet, hot blast through my dress, against my hot nakedness, moaning. "You got to wait a little while, then I'll tend to you." She follows me into the barn where I set the bucket down. She breathes into the bucket, moaning. "I told you, you just got to wait now. I got more to do than I can tend to." The barn is dark. When I pass, he kicks the wall a single blow. I go on. The broken plank is like a pale plank standing on end. Then I can see the slope, feel the air moving on my face again, slow, pale with lesser dark, and with empty seeing, the pine clumps blotched up the tilted slope, secret and waiting. The cow in silhouette against the door nuzzles at the silhouette of the bucket, moaning. Then I pass the stall. I have almost passed it. I listen to it, saying for a long time before it can say the word, and the listening part is afraid that there may not be time to say it. I feel my body, my bones and flesh beginning to part and open upon the alone, and the process of coming unalone is terrible. Leif. 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 I lean a little forward, 1 foot advanced with dead walking. I feel the darkness rushing past my breast, past the cow. I begin to rush upon the darkness, but the cow stops me, and the darkness rushes upon the sweet blast of her moaning breath, filled with wood and with silence. "Vardaman. You, Vardaman." He comes out of the stall. "You darn little sneak. You darn little sneak." He does not resist. The last of rushing darkness flees, whistling away. "What? I ain't done nothing." "You darn little sneak." My hands shake him hard. Maybe I couldn't stop them. I didn't know they could shake so hard. They shake both of us, shaking. "I never done it," he says. "I never touched them." My hands stop shaking him, but I still hold him. "What are you doing here? Why didn't you answer when I called you?" "I ain't doing nothing." "You go on to the house and get your supper." He draws back. I hold him. "You quit now. You leave me be." "What were you doing down here? You didn't come down here to sneak after me?" "I never. I never." "You quit now. I didn't even know you was down here. You leave me be." I hold him, leaning down to see his face, feel it with my eyes. He is about to cry. "Go on now. I done put supper on, and I'll be there soon as I milk. You better go on before he eats everything up. I hope that team runs clean back to Jefferson." "He killed her," he says. He begins to cry. "Hush." "She never hurt him, and he come and killed her." "Hush." He struggles. I hold him. "Hush." "He killed her." The cow comes up behind us, moaning. I shake him again. "You stop it now, right this minute. You're fixing to make yourself sick, and then you can't go to town. You go on to the house and eat your supper."
"I don't want no supper. I don't want to go to town."
"We'll leave you here, then. Lessen you behave, we will leave you. Go on now, before that old green-eating tub of guts eats everything up from you." He goes on, disappearing slowly into the hill. The crest, the trees, the roof of the house stand against the sky. The cow nuzzles at me, moaning. "You'll just have to wait. What you got in you ain't nothing to what I got in me, even if you are a woman, too." She follows me, moaning. Then the dead, hot, pale air breathes on my face again. He could fix it all right if he just would. And he don't even know it. He could do everything for me if he just knowed it. The cow breathes upon my hips and back, her breath warm, sweet, stertorous, moaning. The sky lies flat down the slope upon the secret clumps. Beyond the hill, sheet lightning stains upward and fades. The dead air shapes the dead earth and the dead darkness, further away than seeing, shapes the dead earth. It lies dead and warm upon me, touching me naked through my clothes. I said, you don't know what worry is. I don't know what it is. I don't know whether I am worrying or not, whether I can or not. I don't know whether I can cry or not. I don't know whether I have tried to or not. I feel like a wet seed wild in the hot, blind earth.
Vardaman. When they get it finished, they are going to put her in it, and then for a long time I couldn't say it. I saw the dark stand up and go whirling away, and I said, are you going to nail her up in it, Cash? 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 I got shut up in the crib. The new door, it was too heavy for me. It went shut. I couldn't breathe because the rat was breathing up all the air. I said, are you going to nail it shut, Cash? Nail it? Nail it? Pa walks around. His shadow walks around over Cash going up and down above the saw at the bleeding plank. Dewey Dell said we will get some bananas. The train is behind the glass, red on the track. When it runs, the track shines on and off. Pa said flour and sugar and coffee cost so much. Because I am a country boy, because boys in town. Bicycles. Why do flour and sugar and coffee cost so much when he is a country boy? Wouldn't you rather have some bananas instead? Bananas are gone. Eaten. Gone. When it runs on the track, shines again. Why ain't I a town boy, Pa? I said. God made me. I did not said to God to made me in the country. If he can make the train, why can't he make them all in the town because flour and sugar and coffee? Wouldn't you rather have bananas? He walks around. His shadow walks around. It was not her. I was there looking. I saw. I thought it was her, but it was not. It was not my mother. She went away when the other one lay down in her bed and drew the quilt up. She went away. Did she go as far as town? She went further than town. Did all those rabbits and possums go further than town? God made the rabbits and possums. He made the train. Why must he make a different place for them to go if she is just like the rabbit? Pa walks around. His shadow does. The saw sounds like it is asleep. And so if Cash nails the box up, she is not a rabbit. And so if she is not a rabbit, I couldn't breathe in the crib and Cash is going to nail it up. And so if she lets him, it is not her. I know. I was there. I saw when it did not be her. I saw. They think it is, and Cash is going to nail it up. It was not her, because it was laying right yonder in the dirt. And now it's all chopped up. I chopped it up. It's laying in the kitchen in the bleeding pan, waiting to be cooked in it. Then it wasn't, and she was. And now it is, and she wasn't. And tomorrow it will be cooked and et, and she will be him and Pa and Cash and Dewey Dell, and there won't be anything in the box, and so she can breathe. It was laying right yonder on the ground. I can get Vernon. He was there, and he seen it. And with both of us, it will be, and then it will not be.
Tull. It was nigh to midnight, and it had set in to rain when he woke us. It had been a misdoubtful night, with the storm making. A night when a fellow looks for most anything to happen before he can get the stock fed and himself to the house, and supper ed and in bed with the rain starting, and when Peabody's team come up, lathered, with the broke harness dragging and the neck yoke betwixt the off creeter's legs, Cora says, "It's Addie Bundren. She's gone at last." "Peabody mought have been to air one of a dozen houses hereabouts," I says. "Besides, how do you know it's Peabody's team?" "Well, ain't it?" she says. "You hitch up now." "What for?" I says. "If she's gone, we can't do nothing till morning. And it fixin' a storm, too." "It's my duty," she says. "You put the team in." "But I wouldn't do it. It stands to reason they'd send for us if they needed us. You don't even know she's gone yet." "Why, don't you know that's Peabody's team? Do you claim it ain't? Well, then. But I wouldn't go. When folks wants a fellow, it's best to wait till they sends for him, I've found." "It's my Christian duty," Cora says. "Will you stand between me and my Christian duty?" "You can stay there all day tomorrow if you want," I says. So when Cora waked me, it had set in to rain. Even while I was going to the door with the lamp and it shining on the glass so he could see I am coming, it kept on knocking. Not loud, but steady, like he might have gone to sleep thumping. But I never noticed how low down on the door the knocking was till I opened it and never seen nothing. I held the lamp up, with the rain sparkling across it and Cora back in the hall saying, "Who is it, Vernon?" But I couldn't see nobody at all at first until I looked down and around the door, lowering the lamp. He looked like a drowned puppy in them overalls, without no hat, splashed up to his knees where he had walked them 4 miles in the mud. "Well, I'll be darned," I says. "Who is it, Vernon?" Cora says. He looked at me, his eyes round and black in the middle like when you throw a light in an owl's face. "You mind that ear fish?" he says. "Come in the house," I says. "What is it? Is your ma Vernon?" Cora says. He stood kind of around behind the door in the dark. The rain was blowing onto the lamp, hissing on it, so I am scared every minute it'll break. "You was there," he says. "You seen it." Then Cora come to the door. "You come right in out in the rain," she says, pulling him in and him watching me. He looked just like a drowned puppy. "I told you," Cora says, "I told you it was a happening. You go and hitch." "But he ain't said," I says. He looked at me, dripping on to the floor. "He's a-ruinin' the rug," Cora says. "You go get the team while I take him to the kitchen." But he hung back, dripping, watching me with them eyes. "You was there. You seen it laying there. Cash is fixin' to nail her up, and it was a-layin' right there on the ground. You seen it. You seen the mark in the dirt. The rain never come up till after I was a-comin' here, so we can get back in time." I'd be darned if it didn't give me the creeps. even when I didn't know yet. But Cora did. "You get that team quick as you can," she says. "He's out in his head with grief and worry." I'd be darned if it didn't give me the creeps. Now and then a fellow gets to thinking about all the sorrow and afflictions in this world, how it's liable to strike anywhere, like lightning. I reckon it does take a powerful trust in the Lord to guard a fellow, though sometimes I think that Cora's a mite overcautious, like she was trying to crowd the other folks away and get in closer than anybody else. But then when something like this happens, I reckon she is right, and you've got to keep after it, and I reckon I am blessed in having a wife that ever strives for sanctity and well-doing like she says I am. Now and then a fellow gets to thinking about it. Not often, though, which is a good thing. For the Lord aimed for him to do and not to spend too much time thinking, because his brain, it's like a piece of machinery. It won't stand a whole lot of racking. It's best when it all runs along the same, doing the day's work and not no one part used no more than needful. I have said, and I say again, that's ever-living thing the matter with Dahl. He just thinks by himself too much. Cora's right when she says all he needs is a wife to straighten him out. And when I think about that, I think that if nothing but being married will help a man, he's darn nigh hopeless. But I reckon Cora's right when she says the reason the Lord had to create women is because man don't know his own good when he sees it. When I come back to the house with the team, they was in the kitchen. She was dressed on top of her nightgown, with a shawl over her head and her umbrella and her Bible wrapped up in the oilcloth, and him sitting on an upturned bucket on the stove zinc where she had put him, dripping onto the floor. "I can't get nothing out in him except about a fish," she says. "It's a judgment on them. I see the hand of the Lord upon this boy for Anse Bundren's judgment and warning. The rain never come up till after I left," he says. "I had done left. I was on the way. And so it was there in the dust. You seen it. Cash is fixing to nail her, but you seen it." When we got there, it was raining hard, and him sitting on the seat between us, wrapped up in Cora's shawl. He hadn't said nothing else, just sitting there with Cora holding the umbrella over him. Now and then Cora would stop singing long enough to say, "It's a judgment on Anse Bundren. May it show him the path of sin he is a-trodden." Then she would sing again, and him sitting there between us, leaning forward a little like the mules couldn't go fast enough to suit him. "It was laying right yonder," he says, "but the rain come up after I'd taken and left, so I can go and open the windows, because Cash ain't nailed her yet." It was long past midnight when we drove the last nail, and almost dusk dawn when I got back home and taken the team out and got back in bed with Cora's nightcap laying on the other pillow. And be darned if even then it wasn't like I could still hear Cora singing and feel that boy leaning forward between us like he was ahead of the mules, and still see Cash going up and down with that saw, and Aunt standing there like a scarecrow, like he was a steer standing knee-deep in a pond, and somebody come by and set the pond up on edge, and he ain't missed it yet. It was nigh toward daybreak when we drove the last nail and toted it into the house, where she was laying on the bed with the window open and the rain blowing on her again. Twice he did it, and him so dead for sleep that Cora says his face looked like one of these here Christmas masts that had done been buried a while and then dug up, until at last they put her into it and nailed it down so he couldn't open the window on her no more. And the next morning they found him in his shirt tail, laying asleep on the floor like a felled steer, and the top of the box bored clean full of holes, and Cash's new auger broke off in the last one. When they'd taken the lid off, they found that two of them had bored onto her face. If it's a judgment, it ain't right, because the Lord's got more to do than that. He's bound to have, because the only burden Ants Bundren's ever had is himself. And when folks talks him low, I think to myself he ain't that less of a man, or he couldn't abhor himself this long. It ain't right. I'd be dern if it is. Because he said, "Suffer little children to come unto me, don't make it right neither." Cora said, "I have bore you what the Lord God sent me. I faced it without fear nor terror, because my faith was strong in the Lord, a bolstering and sustaining me. If you have no son, it's because the Lord has decreed otherwise in his wisdom. And my life is and has ever been a open book to e'er a man or woman among his creatures, because I trust in my God and my reward." I reckon she's right. I reckon if there's e'er a man or woman anywhere that he could turn it all over to and go away with his mind at rest, it would be Cora. And I reckon she would make a few changes, no matter how he was running it. And I reckon they would be for man's good. Leastways, we would have to like them. Leastways, we might as well go on and make like we did.
Darl. The lantern sits on a stump, rusted, grease-fouled, its cracked chimney smeared on one side with a soaring smudge of soot. It sheds a feeble and sultry glare upon the trestles and the boards and the adjacent earth. Upon the dark ground, the chips look like random smears of soft, pale paint on a black canvas. The boards look like long, smooth tatters torn from the flat darkness and turned backside out. Cash labors about the trestles, moving back and forth, lifting and placing the planks with long, clattering reverberations in the dead air, as though he were lifting and dropping them at the bottom of an invisible well, the sounds ceasing without departing, as if any movement might dislodge them from the immediate air in reverberant repetition. He saws again, his elbow flashing slowly, a thin thread of fire running along the edge of the saw, lost and recovered at the top and bottom of each stroke in unbroken elongation, so that the saw appears to be 6 feet long, into and out of Pa's shabby and aimless silhouette. "Give me that plank," Cash says. "No, the other one." He puts the saw down and comes and picks up the plank he wants, sweeping Pa away with the long swinging gleam of the balanced board. The air smells like sulfur. Upon the impalpable plane of it, their shadows form as upon a wall, as though like sound they had not gone very far away in falling, but had merely congealed for a moment, immediate and musing. Cash works on, half turned into the feeble light, one thigh and one pole-thin arm braced, his face sloped into the light with a rapt, dynamic immobility above his tireless elbow. Below the sky, sheet lightning slumbers lightly. Against it, the trees, motionless, are ruffled out to the last twig, swollen, increased, as though quick with young. It begins to rain. The first harsh, sparse, swift drops rush through the leaves and across the ground in a long sigh, as though of relief from intolerable suspense. They are big as buckshot, warm as though fired from a gun. They sweep across the lantern in a vicious hissing. Paul lifts his face, slack-mouthed, the wet black rim of snuff plastered close along the base of his gums. From behind his slack-faced astonishment, he muses, as though from beyond time, upon the ultimate outrage. Cash looks once at the sky, then at the lantern. The saw has not faltered, the running gleam of its pistoning edge unbroken. "Get something to cover the lantern," he says. Pa goes to the house. The rain rushes suddenly down, without thunder, without warning of any sort. He is swept onto the porch upon the edge of it, and in an instant Cash is wet to the skin. Yet the motion of the saw has not faltered, as though it and the arm functioned in a tranquil conviction that rain was an illusion of the mind. Then he puts down the saw and goes and crouches above the lantern, shielding it with his body, his back shaped lean and scrawny by his wet shirt, as though he had been abruptly turned wrong side out, shirt and all. Pa returns. He is wearing Jewel's raincoat and carrying Dewey Dell's. Squatting over the lantern, Cash reaches back and picks up four sticks and drives them into the earth and takes Dewey Dell's raincoat from Pa and spreads it over the sticks, forming a roof above the lantern. Pa watches him.
"I don't know what you'll do," he says. "Dar'll taken his coat with him."
"Get wet," Cash says. He takes up the saw again. Again, it moves up and down, in and out of that unhurried imperviousness as a piston moves in the oil, soaked, scrawny, tireless, with the lean, light body of a boy or an old man. Pa watches him, blinking, his face streaming. Again he looks up at the sky with that expression of dumb and brooding outrage, and yet a vindication, as though he had expected no less. Now and then he stirs, moves, gaunt and streaming, picking up a board or a tool and then laying it down. Vernon Tull is there now, and Cash is wearing Mrs. Tull's raincoat, and he and Vernon are hunting the saw. After a while, they find it in Pa's hand. "Why don't you go on to the house, out of the rain?" Cash says. Pa looks at him, his face streaming slowly. It is as though upon a face carved by a savage caricaturist, a monstrous burlesque of all bereavement flowed. "You go on in," Cash says. "Me and Vernon can finish it." Pa looks at them. The sleeves of Jewel's coat are too short for him. Upon his face, the rain streams, slow as cold glycerin.
"I don't begrudge her the wedding," he says.
He moves again and falls to shifting the planks, picking them up, laying them down again carefully, as though they are glass. He goes to the lantern and pulls at the propped raincoat until he knocks it down, and Cash comes and fixes it back.
"You get onto the house," Cash says.
He leads Pa to the house and returns with the raincoat and folds it and places it beneath the shelter where the lantern sits. Vernon has not stopped. He looks up, still sawing.
"You ought to done that at first," he says. "You knowed it was fixing to rain."
"It's his fever," Cash says. He looks at the board.
"Aye," Vernon says. "He'd have come anyway."
Cash squints at the board. On the long flank of it, the rain crashes steadily, myriad, fluctuant.
"I'm going to bevel it," he says.
"It'll take more time," Vernon says.
Cash sets the plank on edge. A moment longer, Vernon watches him. Then he hands him the plane. Vernon holds the board steady while Cash bevels the edge of it with the tedious and minute care of a jeweler. Mrs. Tull comes to the edge of the porch and calls Vernon.
"How near are you done?" she says.
Vernon does not look up.
"Not long. Some yet."
She watches Cash stooping at the plank, the turgid, savage gleam of the lantern slicking on the raincoat as he moves.
You go down and get some planks off the barn and finish it, and come in out of the rain, she says. You'll both catch your death.
Vernon does not move.
Vernon, she says. We won't be long, he says. We'll be done after a spell.
Mrs. Tull watches them a while. Then she re-enters the house.
If we get in a tight, we could take some of them planks, Vernon says. I'll help you put them back.
Cash ceases the plane and squints along the plank, wiping it with his palm.
Give me the next one, he says.